Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Each year, Interfaith Dialogue Association presents a free public lecture to honor the memory of one of Grand Rapids' interfaith pioneers, Rabbi Philip Siegel, who at the end of his life led our local conservative synagogue, Ahavas Israel. His widow, Dr. Lillian Siegel, co-founded Interfaith Dialogue Association and served as its first president. The 2017 event's speaker was Simranjeet Singh, who spoke on Islamophobia, hate crimes, and the racialization of religious identity. Dr. Singh is a Sikh, and Sikhs are often mistaken for Muslims. Hence, they can attract the same level of disparagement and hate crimes as the adherents of Islam. Simran Singh is an assistant professor of religion at the University of Texas. Today, we will listen to part one of his lecture, delivered here at Grand Valley State University earlier this year.
I want to thank you all for being here, and I'm especially grateful to the students who are here supporting this event in the name of community building. And students, your participation in conversations like these is incredibly important. Your time, your energy, but really allowing yourself to be shaped by conversations of difficult conversations is incredibly important for your formation, and we're grateful to you for that. I also want to express my gratitude for those who helped organize this event. So the Kauffman Interfaith Institute, the Division of Inclusion and Equity, the Religious Studies Program, and the Community Reading Project. Thank you for recognizing the importance of what's going on in our country right now and creating a space where we can talk about it and learn from it. For me, what's happening in our nation right now is scary. It's dangerous. It's life-threatening. We are seeing a world that is being increasingly fractured along the lines of religion and race. It is affecting our communities. It's affecting our families. And I think it's as important now as ever to understand what's happening, why it's happening, how it's happening, so that we can start thinking about, well, then how do we deal with these issues? But my sincere belief as a scholar and an activist is that first we need to understand why things are happening in the way that they are before we can come up with solutions. It's like a doctor, right? A doctor first has to understand the root causes before making a diagnosis, and then we prescribe the remedy. That's the approach we need to take. And my basic thesis is that I'll present to you that our understanding of Islamophobia is off a little bit, and we need to revisit what's going on. And that's what I'll try and present to you here today. What I've already learned and what I'm hoping to learn from you all in our conversations has to do with the human experience. There are some deeply troubling developments in our country, and one from among them is the surge of anti-Muslim sentiment. And I won't mince any words here. Hate incidents targeting Muslims are at their highest rate since the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Islamophobic rhetoric from our media, from our politicians, is at the worst I've ever seen in my lifetime. And essentially, what we're seeing in our society today is that an entire group of people, Muslims, are being targeted and marginalized for how they look and what they believe. Now, this goes against our very basic principles as a nation, but it's happening anyway, and we need to take that seriously. The flames of Islamophobia are being fueled in a way that we are not understanding properly, and therefore we are not able to address that properly. Entire lives and families, communities are being destroyed, and we learn of more attacks every single day, from mosque vandalisms and threatening letters to hate speech and violent crimes. So my belief is that we no longer have the luxury or the privilege to simply sit back and condemn hate crimes when they occur. I think that's important, but we have a responsibility as a society to become more proactive, to take a stance, to stand with our Muslim sisters and brothers. So this evening, I aim to play the twin roles of scholar and activist. My simple outlook as a scholar activist is that we must do the rigorous intellectual work of understanding what's happening, and even those of us who sympathize with Muslims in this situation need to push a little bit further. And so I'll draw on perspectives, ideas, and personal experiences that I think will challenge our simplistic understanding of Islamophobia as nothing more than a fear of Islam. And I'll offer evidence to explain why I think it's more complex than that and why we must look at Islamophobia at the intersection of religion and racism. I'll illustrate this argument primarily through the experience of the Sikh American community. And this is the religious community with which I identify. That's partially the reason why I choose this community. My experiences as a Sikh who has faced extreme anti-Muslim sentiment has shaped me as a person from childhood. And it's formed, it's directed my scholarship. It's directed my activism. It's made me who I am today. And so this is part of the reason I draw from the Sikh American experience. But I also do so because the unique Sikh identity has long marked us as different, visibly different, in various global contexts. And in modern America, our appearance, typically including the brown skin, the facial hair, the turban, these mark us as what is perceived to be Muslim in modern America. And in many unfortunate incidents, including what happened here in Grand Rapids about a year and a half ago, these are incidents in which people with animus towards Muslims have directed their hate at Sikhs. And this is why I believe racism has to be discussed in the context of Islamophobia. So what I want to do is begin with the story of a man named Balbir Singh Sodhi. Balbir Singh Sodhi was the first casualty of a hate crime in post-9/11 America. Just 4 days after the attacks, after the Twin Towers were brought down, Balbir Singh Sodhi was shot down and murdered in Mesa, Arizona. And let me just begin by starting with his story. On September 15th, 2001, a man named Frank Silva Roque visited the Wild Hare, a local bar in Mesa, Arizona, where he openly threatened to kill Middle Eastern people. Roque was reported to have stated, "If one of them came into the door right now, I'd slit their throats." According to police reports, Roque was noticeably intoxicated and upset about the terrorist attacks of 9/11. He was kicked out of the bar, but before he left, he asserted that something was going to go down real soon and that it might even be tonight. Witnesses would later testify to hearing anti-Muslim speech from Roque. For example, his coworker reported Roque as saying, "We should round them all up and kill them. We should kill their children too, because they'll grow up to be like their parents." According to police reports, Frank Roque had told his wife that all Arabs should be shot and that he wanted to slit some Iranian throats. Upon leaving the bar that afternoon, Frank Roque drove his black Chevy S10 to a local Chevron station, where the owner, Balbir Singh Sodhi, was outside, working with his landscaper, Luis Ledesma. Roque approached Sodhi and Ledesma and aimed his .38 handgun through the open window of the truck. 5 bullets struck Sodhi, killing him instantly. And Balbir Singh Sodhi became the first casualty of a hate crime in post-9/11 America. Now, to this day, more than 15 years later, scholars and journalists continue to characterize the murder of Balbir Singh Sodhi as a case of mistaken identity. They have argued that Sodhi's unique Sikh identity, the turban, the facial hair, his brown skin, led Roque to perceive him as a Muslim and therefore kill him in Islamophobic hate. Now, the notion of mistaken identity implies that while Roke intended to kill a Muslim, he unintentionally targeted a Sikh instead. And so in the next 20 minutes or so, I'll explain why I think the framework of mistaken identity is both simplistic and problematic, and I'll present a more nuanced approach for understanding hate violence that takes into account key examples from our present context, such as the anti-Muslim rhetoric that we're seeing today, the recent massacre of Sikhs in Wisconsin, the brutalization of young Jewish student here in Michigan, and the recent murder of an Indian immigrant in Kansas. So let me begin by discussing why the framework of mistaken identity is problematic. First, the term itself implies that there is a correct identity that ought to be targeted. It suggests that while Sikhs are the incorrect target, that Muslims should be the correct target. And in a society that has increasingly that has become increasingly skeptical about Islam and about Muslims, this is an incredibly dangerous subtext to perpetuate. In the case of Balbir Singh Sodhi, the murder would be just as unacceptable if the victim was a Muslim rather than a Sikh. So the framework of mistaken identity redirects hate violence towards a different minority community and actually fails to consider the root cause of such violence. Second, the term mistaken identity implies that acts of hate violence are unintentional. By characterizing a hate crime as a mistake, we diminish the agency of the perpetrator. And in doing so, we lessen the degree to which we hold the culprits accountable. So our current framework does not hold perpetrators accountable on the basis of their actions or motives, but rather on whether or not they got the right person. This is wrong.
You're listening to WGVU's Common Threads. Today, we're listening to part one of Dr. Simranjeet Singh as he delivers the 2017 Siegel Lecture entitled Islamophobia, Hate Crimes, and the Racialization of Religious Identity.
Third, the notion of mistaken identity is flawed because it gives us the impression that particular acts of hate violence are isolated and anomalous events. By focusing on the specific targeted community or intended targeted community, we localize, separate, and limit our understanding of the violence. So, for example, we focus on hate crimes on the basis of which groups are targeted. We talk about anti-Semitic hate crimes or anti-Muslim hate crimes, without connecting these within the broader problem of hate. Over the last several months, mosques around the country have been attacked, desecrated, destroyed, demolished, vandalized. A few years ago, there was an attack here in Michigan State University, where a young Jewish undergraduate student was beaten unconscious, they broke his jaw, they stapled his mouth shut, and they left him for dead. And approximately 20 people witnessed the violence. No one intervened. As far as we know, the attackers were neo-Nazis and members of the KKK that targeted him just because he was Jewish. Just yesterday, we learned of a Muslim family in Oregon whose house was broken into and vandalized with anti-Muslim speech, spray painted all over the house. The house was destroyed. And I don't want to say the actual words that were used in the hate speech, but you can look it up. It's horrific. It's really ugly stuff. Yet due to our approach of understanding hate violence as specific incidents, isolated events, we don't connect the dots. We're not talking about the patterns of hate that are ravaging our country. We're brushing them off as mistakes, as accidents, as random events. And lastly, mistaken identity is problematic because it gives us the impression that hate violence, that hate, only occurs in specific moments of time. Looking at hate as an isolated event, we overlook the processes that are leading up to these moments. We see these instances as ruptures in time as opposed to historically developed things that are happening in our communities without ever really addressing them. And what we end up doing instead is we focus on the symptoms as opposed to the disease of hate. So mistaken identity is a flawed tool for understanding hate violence in our society. It fails to question the intent of the perpetrators. It dismisses the culprit's accountability. It decontextualizes the violence itself, and it dehistoricizes hate by freezing it in an isolated moment of time. So in the place of mistaken identity, I want to offer an alternative framework for understanding what's happening with anti-Muslim sentiment here in America. And the framework that I propose is called the racialization of identity. Now, following the attacks of 9/11, our country experienced a rise of backlash, incredible backlash, against minority communities. The hate crimes targeted people who resembled the perpetrators. Not the perpetrators themselves, but anybody who looked like they might have an affiliation with them. And this targeted violence crystallized a new racial category in modern America. And this is the apparent Muslim. Anybody who appears to be Muslim, it doesn't matter if you are or if you're not. It matters if you appear to be, if you look like somebody who might be Muslim. Now, it's not an officially recognized racial classification, but this has become a de facto racial category that has become a defining reality for all those who fall under its scope. The most adversely affected have been those belonging to Muslim communities, but this also includes people who belong to Sikh communities, Arab communities, South Asian communities, anybody who falls within our current stereotype of what a Muslim looks like. And let me share a sort of academic explanation of what's going on here by a scholar named Jadeep Singh. While physical appearance normally correlates to race in the U.S., in many cases, the visible markers which distinguish the victims of post-9/11 hate crimes were not solely or even primarily racial, but actually religious signifiers, such as the hijab or the turban. In this context, these religious symbols became racialized indicators in the eyes of the vigilante racists that carried out these assaults. Although the subtlety of this distinction was likely lost on these perpetrators of hatred, the phenotypical coding shared by many of the victims of post-9/11 hate crimes was comprised of two distinct features, a religious and a racial component. The experiences of the Sikh, Muslim, South Asian, and Arab communities after 9/11 have offered convincing evidence of an ongoing process in which religious identity has become racialized. In each of these communities, race and religion have commingled to form an indispensable aspect of an othered identity, which is not only clearly outside of the nation's mainstream, but one that has been criminalized by the state. What has resulted is a phenomenon in which visible religious identity becomes the determining factor which renders individuals vulnerable to the phenotypically based social degradation and potential violence normally reserved for racialized minorities in this nation's history. Now, what Professor Singh is saying here is that the new racialized category of the apparent Muslim is determined according to the visible markers of race and religion. There's an intersection here that's important for us to recognize. These markers classify distinct peoples of various backgrounds, religious, racial, ethnic backgrounds, into a single category on the basis of similar characteristics, such as skin color, head coverings, and facial hair. To outside observers, it doesn't matter whether they are practitioners of Islam or not. It just matters that they look like Muslims on the basis of these racial and religious signifiers. The racialization of religious identity provides an alternative for the framework of mistaken identity. Here's why it's better. For one, it negates the implication of a correct identity for targeting and hate violence. It doesn't say get those guys instead, right? It says these people are all part of a single community based on our social constructions. This approach allows us to retain the distinctions between the two major religious traditions who are affected, Muslims and Sikhs, and it accounts for the perception by which Sikhs and Muslims are conflated without suggesting that there is a correct or mistaken target. The racialization of religious identity also allows us to historicize the construction of hate, to understand the process through racialization, rather than assuming that violence just occurs in transient moments. And this framework also allows us to place hate crimes committed against Sikhs within the broader context of hate violence in America. In essence, the violence is not mistaken. Rather, it just targets a newly racialized identity of the apparent Muslim. And such contextualization guides us to think about anti-Sikh, anti-South Asian, anti-Arab hate crimes within the framework or within the broader phenomenon of Islamophobia. Now, the racialization of religious identity helps us better understand hate violence against Muslims and non-Muslims alike. It specifically helps us understand what is happening in the perpetrator's mind when he kills Balbir Singh Sodhi. And let me return to his story briefly and tell you what happened next. After killing Sodhi, Frank Roque immediately sped off to a home that he previously owned and had sold to an Afghani-American couple. He fired 3 shots at their home before proceeding to a mobile gas station where he fired 7 shots at Lebanese-American Anwar Khalil. Fortunately, no one was killed in these 2 shootings. So these shootings have not been told in sort of the public space. But they happened. And Roque then visited another local bar, where a patron reported him as bragging, "They're investigating the murder of a turbanhead down the street." When the police came to arrest him at his home later that day, Roque put up his hands in surrender and announced, "I'm a patriot and an American. I'm a damn American." On the way to the police station, Roque asked the officers driving the patrol car, "How can you arrest me and let the terrorists run wild?" He later added, "I wish that my punishment would be sending me to Afghanistan with a lot of fucking weapons." Frank Roque's words and actions reflect a racialized understanding of the Muslim other. The words and epithets he used to describe his targets were not limited to practitioners of Islam, but instead they fit the broader profile of the apparent Muslim. In his words, Arabs, ragheads, terrorists, Middle Eastern, Iranians, turbanheads, Afghanistan. These are ethnic, religious, national signifiers. These are not just religious signifiers. This is racism here, based on a perception of the other. From this perspective, Balbir Singh Sodhi, a Sikh man, fit into his stereotype of the Muslim other. The brown skin, the turban, the facial hair is what Roque identified as the markers of the Muslim enemy.
You've been listening to part 1 of Dr. Simranjeet Singh's talk, Islamophobia, Hate Crimes, and the Racialization of Religious Identity, the 2017 IDA Philip Siegel Lecture. Please join us next week for part 2. I'm Fred Stella. This is Common Threads on WGVU.